طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. And that is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. Today we feature a forum sponsored by the Harvard Divinity School's Religion, Conflict, Peace Initiative, which features an examination of Leila Farsak's new book, Rethinking Statehood in Palestine, Self-Determination and Decolonization Beyond Partition. Leila Farsak is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. She is joined by two colleagues who each wrote a chapter in the book, Maha Nasser, who is Associate Professor of Modern Middle East History and Islamic Studies at the University of Arizona, and Susan Akram, Clinical Professor of Law at Boston University School of Law. The forum is moderated by Harvard Divinity School Fellow Rabia Egbaria. He introduces the forum.
This event is organized by the RCPI Initiative, the Religion, Conflict, and Peace Initiative at the Harvard Divinity School. And today we'll be discussing the Rethinking Statehood in Palestine, Self-Determination, and Decolonization Beyond Partition. We'll start with, I'll just jump right into it. I want us to save the time for as many topics we can cover today. We'll do a couple rounds of questions and then open it up again, as I said, for questions from the audience. We'll start with Leila. Leila Farsak is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. She's the editor of Rethinking Statehood in Palestine, that came out, by the way, just last year in 2021, and co-editor of the Arab and Jewish Questions, Geography of Engagement in Palestine and Beyond. She's also the author of the great, excellent book, the Palestinian Labor Migration to Israel, Labor Land, and Occupation. That's how I actually first encountered Leila. She has published on questions related to political economy of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, alternatives to partition, and international migration in wide range of academic journals. Please, Leila, the floor is yours. I wanted to ask you, as a way to kick us off, if you can, you edited this wonderful book, and it is really rich. It's a book that covers and many, many different chapters and rethinks, as it says, the question of statehood. Where did it come from? The relationship between statehood, nation, self-determination, and decolonization. Can you tell us how it came into being and what are the main themes? How did partition come to dominate the discourse over Palestine, and why it is urgent to reopen the question of partition today?
Thank you very much for this introduction and for my co-contributors who are here, because I love presenting this book with those who made it such a good book. The idea of the book, as the title says, Rethinking Statehood in Palestine, really emerged out of a work I did. I started with the University of Birzeit over 8 years ago. And the idea was behind it is that partition is not working because the Palestinian quest for statehood, which actually today, out of all days, the November 15th, is actually the 34th anniversary of the Palestinian Declaration of Independence. Actually, 34 years ago, the PLO decided to declare its independence, recognize UN Resolution 242, recognize Israel, and as a way, paved the way for the negotiations, the peace process. And from its perspective, the PLO imagined, okay, we cannot have our dream of a one-state solution because the international consensus is based on partition in Palestine. So the only way by which the Palestinians can fulfill their rights, even if they're not achieved for justice, is to establish their state in the West Bank and Gaza, and through this affirm their right to self-determination and gather the refugees also in this little state. Now, as we realize, also peace process proved that it redefined the Israeli occupation rather than ended. And what we ended up having is a reality that is more analogous to an apartheid reality than actually to a viable two-state solution, which has been the international consensus to solve this problem. Despite the fact that by 2022, the state of Palestine has been officially recognized by 138 states and admitted into the UN as a non-member state, it is far from being sovereign or free. So the question and actually reality today is that the Israel continuous war and siege on Gaza for the past 16 years, we have over 750,000 settlers in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. We have the institutionalization of over 99 Israeli checkpoints and the building of the separation barrier, which fragments the Palestinian land into unconnected and unviable state. So the question became, why, despite this apartheid reality, the Palestinian Authority, Hamas, and the international community continue to be committed to the two-state solution? So what the book starts to do by gathering these various scholars, mostly Palestinians, and what I call the two honorary Palestinians, par excellence, Susan Akram and Ilan Pappé, but apart from that, everybody else is Palestinian in this book. And I also cared about having a gender balance because women are also producers of knowledge on Palestine. What this book tries to do is really two things. One is to try and explain why this attachment to partition and to statehood, and what cost did it cause to the Palestinian in being attached to partition and statehood to partition. And secondly, what are the alternatives to partition by analyzing the opportunities and cost of moving away from the pursuit of territorial sovereignty to achieve political liberation. So the first part of the book focuses on why are we still attached to partition and what are the costs involved in being attached to partition. Now, I have a chapter on Jerusalem, I have a chapter on Gaza by Bakoni, there's a chapter also on activism for Palestine in the US, shows that the cost of being attached to partition was very high and is stated just in the West Bank and Gaza, because it basically fragmented the Palestinian reality, decomposed the Palestinian nation, and actually deprived Palestinians of their basic human rights, let alone their political rights. But there's also the realist argument. The realist argument argues that given the international recognition of Palestinian right to self-determination and statehood, why give it up by rejecting partition and calling for a one-state solution? Many argue that the international consensus on partition and the two-state solution makes it that it is the only option available. For these realists, the problem is how we're going to force Israel to adhere to international resolution, not so much destroy the two-state solution. This, however, is a limited argument, and as one chapter in the book shows, the one by Adam Haniya, it is important to analyze the political economy of the Palestinian state project to understand why there is still an attachment to it. In other words, it's not a question of a realist argument, it's more a question of who stands to win and lose from a Palestinian state project. And as the beautiful chapter by Adam Haniya shows, the Palestinian state project was and the partition plan was sustained and financed by Palestinians and other capitalists who made their money in the Gulf. And as we see now, the signing of the Abraham Accords, all those shows that we cannot understand the Palestinian state project and the partition paradigm without understanding the geostrategic interest and the geostrategic capital movement. But I also argue in the book that there's another reason why we are still attached to the Palestinian state idea. And the reason is that it affirms the Palestinian right to self-determination. Now, today it might sound absurd because everybody knows who the Palestinians are. Palestinian cause is very visible, even if it is continuously under attack. But this was not the case 50 years ago when UN Resolution 242, which became the base of every peace settlement, negated the existence of the Palestinians. So what I argue in this book is that the Palestinian state was a necessary but not sufficient step to affirm Palestinian right to self-determination. And the reason why it was not sufficient, it is because it was based on a partition paradigm. Partition paradigm that is based on an imperial structure of domination and power. In other words, the world system we are in, which affirms state sovereignty, has a limited understanding of sovereignty and ties sovereignty with imperial structure of domination, rather than based on a concept of justice and equality and remaking the world order into a more just and equal one, as the Third Worldist movement tried to do. Secondly, I argue that partition has failed because it was based, and the Palestinian state also, was based on the idea of accepting Zionism rather than dismantling its colonial structure. In other words, the Palestinian leadership accepted to forgo the question of colonialism rather than undo it, as UN Resolution 1514 in 1960 affirmed that colonialism is a crime and needed to be fought. So the problem is, by accepting partition, you accepted a colonial structure of domination rather than decolonize it. So it was bound that the Palestinian state project failed to bring any justice or any solution. So it became necessary then to revisit partition or to go beyond partition, because for whatever, you know, whatever we can argue, the Palestinian state project delivered something important, which is recognition of Palestinian right to self-determination, but it could not deliver this independence because it was based on partition. So what are the alternatives? How can we think about a one-state solution that can affirm Palestinian rights? And what are the challenges? What are the issues that we need to address in doing that? And this is what the second part of the book does, where the chapter by Maha Nassar and Susan Akram provide brilliant insight into what are the challenges that we need to look for. And in this regard, I would like to point out four main points, which some of which will be discussed later, that this book raises and tell us that we need to address in any attempt to go beyond partition. First, we need to revisit the relationship between the nation and the state. The nation typically is a much more inclusive term. It's an imagined community, and it should not be tied to the state. That we need to move away from the strict jacket of the nation state, because it automatically leads to exclusion and restrictive. We need to rehabilitate the understanding of a state as a juridical order responsible for maintaining equality of all the citizens living on the land. Secondly, and as I said, Susan Akram will go more into this question of the relationship between the nation and the state, or more the nation. Secondly, we need to expand our understanding of decolonization. We understand decolonization as a decolonization of the land. This is important, but it is not limited just to the land. What is becoming clear today in this apartheid reality that we exist, is decolonization is a process of decolonizing relationships and not just relationship over the land. It entails internal decolonization, as Fanon reminded us. And it involves also decolonizing Israel from within by emphasizing Palestinian indigeneity. These are challenging questions, but we need to think more about, and actually lots is being done on the ground on it. Thirdly, we need to start articulating how do we address the right of others. In other words, those who are not Palestinians. This means that as Palestinians, we need to address the question of Zionism and how to decolonize Israel from within. But this is a very difficult question, but it's a question that also pertains to the whole region. We are all regionally also in need of discussing how do we accept the other among us as an equal based on equality, not on domination? And fourthly, last but not least, is the challenge of how do you create the political movement for a one-state idea that can answer and provide answers to the three challenges I described above. There is lots of work being done on that, but I would like to stop here, because I think I can take it up in the question and answer and let my co-contributor have their say. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Leila, for this brilliant introduction. It really is, grounding us in these discussions about the state and how state discourses, you know, one state versus two state solutions have become to dominate. The discourse is also internally in Palestine many times, and to this we'll come later with Maha's chapter about Palestinian citizens of Israel and the discourses around state solutions there. But before that, I want to move to Susan, actually. And, you know, Leila, you mentioned the distinction, you implied the distinction between the sociological account of nationality versus perhaps the legal definition of it. And Susan has a brilliant chapter, fascinating study about the legal status of citizenship and Palestinian nationality versus Jewish nationality. Now, I just want to lay out a few terms here that Susan will hopefully help us make sense out of them all. We many times hear, you know, Jewish, Israeli, Palestinian nationality. Many times Jewish and Israeli nationalities are used interchangeably. And of course, you know, this is part of a wider discursive use of terms that many times also confuses Semitism or Semites with Jews and Israelis and Zionists. These are four different terms that many times are used interchangeably. Now, I want to move to Susan for this major task of clarifying, you know, what is the differences between the perhaps sociological account of nationality and the legal account of it. What is the international law definition of nationality and how it pertains to Jewish, Israeli, and Palestinian nationalities? I just want to introduce Susan because, of course, I did not do that. Susan directs the Boston University Law's International Human Rights Clinic, in which she supervises students engaged in international advocacy in domestic, international, regional, and UN fora. Her research and publications focus on immigration, asylum, refugee, forced migration, and human rights issues with an interest in the Middle East, the Arab and Muslim worlds. So, Susan, thank you. The floor is yours.
Thank you so much for inviting me and for this task of covering Palestinian nationality in about 5 minutes. I will do my best, but the legal story or the legal source of Palestinian nationality begins with the Ottoman Empire. Palestine was part of the Ottoman Empire until 1923, and on 6th of August 1924, under the terms of the Lausanne Treaty, Ottoman citizens who resided in the territory of Palestine became Palestinian citizens, Palestinian nationals. As a matter of international law, Palestinian nationality was formed on this date. Following the Lausanne Treaty, each of the former Ottoman territories, including Palestine, had a citizenship law that codified their nationality statuses. During the League of Nations period, Palestinian citizenship was codified by British law, the Palestine Citizenship Order of 1925, and the Palestine Citizenship Order afforded Palestinian citizenship to all who were Turkish Ottoman subjects or citizens at the time of the Lausanne Treaty and were habitually resident in Palestine. The population meeting this criteria numbered 847,000 people. Under the British citizenship law, Palestinians could obtain passports, and over 70,000 Palestine passports were issued. Now, by 1901, of course, the World Zionist Organization had established the Jewish National Fund to purchase land for Jewish settlers in Palestine. Although the Zionists interpreted the Balfour Declaration of 1917 as the endorsement of the declaration, as a British commitment to the Jewish people or the creation of a Jewish state in Palestine, there are serious deficiencies in this interpretation. Britain had no legal authority to create any political entity in Palestine that disregarded the rights of the indigenous Palestinian population, and nothing in the historical or legal history gives support for a claim that the Balfour Declaration or any other instrument recognized Jewish nationality attached to a distinct population of individuals who were entitled to self-determination in Palestine. The next major legal historical development relevant to the question of Palestinian nationality was the passage of Resolution 181, the Partition Plan, on 29 November 1947. First, it's important to understand the actual provisions of 181. Jews who were given citizenship during the mandate were those actually residing in Palestine, not outside. Resolution 181's recognition of a Jewish and an Arab state did refer to religious and racial criteria, but referred to them as the two peoples of Palestine. The plan's principle was that Palestinian citizens, regardless of their religion, residing in the Arab state would become citizens of the Arab state. Palestinian citizens residing in the Jewish state, regardless of their religion, would become citizens of the Jewish state. Second, the partition plan did not authorize either state to institutionalize superior rights for any religious or racial group. It preserved Palestinian nationality. This is the most important point I want to make. 181 preserved Palestinian nationality stemming from the Lausanne Treaty and included Jews habitually resident in Palestine, eligible for Palestinian citizenship, who were living on the territory. The next important act from the United Nations was Resolution 194. And that 194's reference to refugees also relates directly to the UN's view of Palestinian nationality in 1948. Resolution 194's paragraph 11, which sets out a legal formula for resolving the refugee problem, has no clear definition of Palestine refugee. The United Nations authoritative interpretations of paragraph 11 state that the term refugees applies to all persons, Arabs, Jews, and others, who've been displaced from their homes in Palestine. These make clear that the UN was defining Palestine refugee as referring to the entire group of persons covered by the Palestinian nationality citizenship laws of 1924-25 that emanated from the Lausanne Treaty. These were all habitual residents and citizens of Palestine, as well as their descendants. Today, such persons would number over 11 million Palestinians worldwide. Although Israel's declaration of its state claimed that the state of Israel would guarantee equal rights for all its citizens without discrimination, shortly afterwards, Israel passed a series of laws that affected the rights and interests of Palestinians to their property, but also permanently affected their legal connection to their homeland, including two separate laws on nationality citizenship. Under Israel's 1950 law of return, immigration to Israel is exclusively reserved for Jews. All Jews are automatically Jewish nationals and part of the Israeli state. No connection to the territory is required under the law, other than to be Jewish. Under Israel's 1952 nationality law, there are four methods of obtaining Israel nationality. These are return, again, for Jews only under the 1950 law, residence in Israel, birth, or naturalization. The law, importantly, retroactively repealed Palestinian citizenship under the Palestinian Citizenship Orders of 1925 to the date that Israel became a state. All Palestinians who could not meet the requirements for obtaining Israeli nationality became stateless under Israeli law, which has been confirmed by the majority of decisions of Israeli courts. What is little understood about the Israeli nationality law is that it creates a legal fiction. There's no such thing as Israeli nationality, as the Israeli High Court itself has confirmed. The only nationality to which rights and privileges are attached is Jewish nationality. The 1950 and 1952 laws set up a two-tiered system, one for Jews who are nationals of Israel and can automatically become citizens, a second for non-Jews who can become citizens but can never become nationals of Israel. Now, the Israeli laws repealing Palestinian citizenship and replacing it with one that denationalized the vast majority of Palestinians in 1950-1952 violate two fundamental customary law principles: that all habitual residents of the territory of a state which succeeds another must be granted citizenship in the new state, and that no state can arbitrarily denationalize habitual residents of its state on the basis of protected grounds, such as race, religion, ethnic, or national origin. If Palestinian nationality remained intact from 1924 because Israel's denationalization was void from an international law perspective, then all Palestinians recognized under that nationality law and all their descendants have the right to claim nationality tied to the territory covered by British mandate dating back to the time of such recognition. And the UN and no international legal instrument has ever recognized such a concept, an extraterritorial concept of Jewish nationality. Let me stop there and we can talk about the consequences of this a little bit later.
Thank you, Susan. I honestly found this article fascinating as a lawyer myself and as a legal scholar. I mean, it reminded me of these internal, also Israeli litigation about the concept of nationhood in the Israeli Supreme Court, which is interesting that to mention perhaps in this context as well, that the Israeli Supreme Court itself reaffirmed in 2013 that there is no Israeli nation in the Israeli state. So that's interesting development within. It was actually a petition of Jewish Israelis to the Israeli Supreme Court demanding that they would be registered as Israeli rather than Jewish in their IDs under the rubric of nationality. And the court said that it reaffirmed a previous precedent from 1970, according to which it ruled that there hasn't been proven that an Israeli nation has formed in the state of Israel, that is in distinction from a Jewish nation. So that's a very fascinating article that even contextualized that in a wider international law context. I want to move now to Maha. Dr. Maha Nassar is an associate professor in the School of Middle Eastern and North African Studies at the University of Arizona, where she specializes in the cultural and intellectual history of the modern Arab world. She holds a PhD from the University of Chicago, and her award-winning book, Brothers Apart, Palestinian Citizens of Israel and the Arab World, published in 2017 by the Stanford University Press, examines how Palestinian intellectuals inside the Green Line connected to global decolonization movements through literary and journalistic writings. So Maha, please take us through this, you know, world of Palestinian citizens of Israel. Your chapter focuses on the trajectory of Palestinian citizens of Israel and their perceptions of the one state versus two state formula. How did it develop over the years, and how did it become the questions that bifurcates the political movement in Palestine within Palestinian citizens?
Well, thank you, Rabia, very much, and it's great to be here. And I'm actually really glad that I'm speaking following Leila and Susan, because I think they set up really well some of what's at stake. And then I think my chapter and what I'm going to be talking about gives a kind of concrete example on the ground of what the actual consequences are of the fact that there isn't a clearly defined Israeli nation, of those consequences of what partition has meant for those Palestinians who remained on their land or who managed to return. So in my chapter, I talk about two main groupings of Palestinian political activists, organizers, and intellectuals in the state of Israel. And they're commonly referred to, today we often talk about them as 48 Palestinians or Palestinians inside. And they are also the groups that I focus on in my book. These are what we might call, in Gramscian terms, organic intellectuals, those who came from within the community and really were pushing up against the power structures, the Zionist power structures, from really the very beginning, from 1948 until today. Before I talk too much about these two groups of Gramscian intellectuals, I do want to acknowledge a third group of what we might call the acquiescent class, those Palestinians in Israel who identify usually as Arab Israelis. They tend to downplay or deny their Palestinianness, and who very much acquiesce to the existing Zionist state structures and worked within them, accommodated themselves to them. And I'll be talking about sort of all of them from, you know, from the beginning until now. So that earliest group, that sort of acquiescent group, joined Arab lists that were affiliated with the Mapai Party, the precursor to the Israeli Labor Party. They worked within Zionist structures, essentially asking for and usually being satisfied with crumbs of bits and pieces. It was often also very much tied to the clan structures of rural Palestinian society. So that's that group. I'm going to put them aside for a moment and we'll come back to them. The two main groups that I talk about in my chapter are the two main oppositional camps. The first is the communist camp. They are they followed the Israeli Communist Party. They're part of the Israeli Communist Party that followed the Palestine Communist Party prior to 48. They were the only non-Zionist political party that accepted Jews and Arabs as equals within the party structures, and that was accepted as a legally sanctioned party in the State of Israel. So from the very first Israeli Knesset elections in 1949, we see members of the Israeli Communist Party being elected to the Knesset, the most famous Palestinian leaders being Emir Habibi and Tawfiq Toubi. And as non-Zionists, they provided a more forceful criticism of the Israeli state. But because they were very much following the lead of the Soviet Union, they were not anti-Zionist. And this is a very important distinction I think we need to make. So they were non-Zionist in the sense they believed that the Zionist state of Israel was inherently discriminatory. But they also accepted from the very beginning the existence of the Israeli state as a Jewish and democratic state, accepted the partition lines and eventually accepted even the expanded armistice lines of Israel, and essentially worked to advance a formula of Jewish-Arab cooperation within the state of Israel that could serve as an alternative to the Zionist and Jewish hegemony of the state. Later on, as we move into the 1960s and 70s, they became early adopters of a two-state vision. So they were among the earliest ones to call for the establishment of a Palestinian state in the territories occupied by Israel in the 1967 war. So calling for a Palestinian state in the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem that would exist side by side with a Jewish and democratic Israeli state. And they continued, and for the most part, continue to today to hold those views. So that's the communist camp. The other camp is the Arab nationalist camp. So these are Palestinians who remained within what became known as the State of Israel, but never really accommodated themselves and never really accepted the idea that Israel should exist as a Jewish and democratic state. They were very much in line ideologically with Arab nationalists during and after the 1948 war, and were very strong supporters of Gamal Abdel Nasser and the Qaumi or pan-Arab nationalist sentiments in the 1950s and 60s. Now, they were what we might call anti-Zionists. They fundamentally opposed Zionism. They saw it as a colonial movement, as a colonial imperialist movement, and did not believe that there was legitimacy to the idea of Israel existing as a Jewish and democratic state. They also very closely adhered ideologically to the emergence of the PLO and Palestinian national rhetoric. They were much more closely surveilled and punished by the Israeli state, particularly because they became early adopters of the idea of a single democratic state, and in some cases, sometimes articulating it as a binational state. And so they were not allowed to function legally. The Ard movement, which was an early manifestation of this ideology, was shut down, sanctioned. Their publications were closed down by the Israelis as well. So moving along then, by the time we get to the 1980s, and later mentioned today as the anniversary of the Declaration of Palestinian Statehood, or Palestinian Independence rather, this marked the ascendance of the two-state vision and a decline in popularity of the one-state vision. And so the Communist Party, both because it operates within the Israeli state structure, the Knesset, and because their positions increasingly aligned with at least the liberal Zionist consensus, gained more traction. The nationalist camp early on refused to participate in the Knesset elections. They saw it as legitimizing the Israeli state when they didn't wish to do so. But by the mid-90s, a group of them started to run in the Knesset elections under the party title, the National Democratic Assembly. So I want to then bring us to today, very briefly. So we saw these three camps, the acquiescent camp, the communist camp, and the nationalist camp, to sort of roughly describe it, in just the last Israeli elections 2 weeks ago. Today, that acquiescent sort of camp is, I think, best represented by Mansour Abbas and the United Arab List, that was willing to enter into Israeli coalition, ruling coalitions. Mansour Abbas does not talk about Palestinians or Palestinian citizens of Israel, identifies himself as an Arab Muslim Israeli. So that's one group. The second, the sort of communist camp, is most clearly articulated today through the Jabha, or the Democratic Front for Peace and Equality. It's also known as Hadash in Hebrew. And Ayman Houda, that party leader, is the best, I think, exemplar of that, who continues to today to support a two-state solution, although he's a bit more quiet about that in recent years. And then the nationalist camp is best exemplified by that National Democratic Assembly Party, also known as a Tejamra or Balad. And in a sort of indication of where we're at, we see that that acquiescent camp is the one spoken about most favorably in Israeli circles, Mansour Abbas and Israeli supporters. Ayman Oud's group with the Jabha, with another party running alongside it, also gets some sort of praise and recognition, although it's being increasingly demonized by the Israeli right, which is also a continuation of what we've seen in trends over the last six decades. And then the Nationalist Party was actually prevented from running initially in this latest election. They appealed to the Supreme Court and were ultimately allowed to run, but they only had a month to campaign, and so ultimately they didn't make the threshold. So we don't have any members of the nationalist camp, the Tejamra, in the current Knesset. So in many ways, the camps and the relationships with Israeli authorities has remained consistent, with some changes over the years. I think very briefly what's changed is that those nationalists are much bolder today and have more direct means of communicating with fellow Palestinians. I think they represent the trends of the future. A lot of younger Palestinian citizens of Israel seem to sympathize more with the nationalists than with the other two. And so there's less patience for that kind of incremental approach of the earlier parties. And with that, I'll stop here.
Thank you. Thank you, Maha, so much. I've just seen that a few people joined late, so I want to, you know, remind us we're here in a book talk about the book, Rethinking Statehood in Palestine. And this event is hosted by the RCPI Initiative at the Harvard Divinity School, and which is kind of leading me to my next set of questions. And please feel free, people in the audience, feel free to drop questions at the Q&A function, and we will get to them later in our talk today. We're running until 1:30 today. Now, Maha, I think this is, being myself a Palestinian citizen of Israel and growing up back there, I think this is a great mapping of the political landscape and how it dealt or developed through, the question of its position vis-a-vis the statehood question. Now, you know, it left me wondering, and maybe I want to start with you. I want to wonder about the role of religion and the location of religion and the state in the one state versus two state paradigms. Religion played an important role from the outset. It overlapped with other forces such as nationalism and colonialism, you know, as Suzanne as well elaborated about the nationality concept versus, you know, Israeli versus Jewish nationality. And, you know, even more historically, when we go back to the partition plan, which Leila has talked about, we see that Jerusalem would have occupied an internationally administrated area with a special status. So how do we reconcile religion in these equations is the broader theme of this set of questions for you all. And I want you to feel free to jump into that. I just want to say maybe perhaps about Palestinian citizens from a legal perspective, that the policing and conditioning of Palestinian political participation in Israel dates, as Maha has mentioned, dates back to Harkat al-Ard, the Ard movement from the 60s and 70s. But legally, the structure of doing this policing or conditioning has changed. Today, where we have a law that after 1980s, there has been a constitutional amendment in the Israeli legal order that allows disqualification, as opposed to what happened with the Al-Ard movement, which was a judicial decision to ban them from political participation. Today, there is a more elaborate scheme of conditioning this political participation, where parties and Palestinian citizens' parties are conditioned to accept or not to negate, basically, the Jewish and democratic character of the state and their platform. This is a fascinating topic in and of itself, which we will not probably have the time to delve into. But I want to go back to the question about the location of religion. And Maha, feel free to jump in if you want to kick us off. I was wondering, where is political Islam in this scheme among Palestinian citizens? I mean, Mansour Abbas obviously is one faction of it, but the other faction is the so-called the Northern Harakat Islamiyya, Islamic movement, which was outlawed around 2017. So I was wondering if you can tell us or a bit more about that, or any other direction you would like to lead us.
Sure, thank you for that. So I think religion is very important, and I think it often gets overlooked because, on the one hand, I think many of us scholars who work on this, and especially those of us who focus on modern Palestine, we get very uncomfortable. I'll speak for myself. I get very uncomfortable when people start talking about this as a quote-unquote religious conflict, because it's not. And I'll elaborate on that point in a moment. And so that's part of it. And then part of it, too, is that oftentimes in our political discourse, people who identify strongly with a particular religion or are visibly observant of one of the three major religions, specifically either Islam or Judaism, are often characterized as either fanatic or uncompromising or an obstacle to peace or blocking reasonable people from reaching agreements and so forth. And I really don't see it that way. I think, Avir, you brought up the northern and southern branches of the Islamic movement in Israel, and I think that's a perfect example of what I'm talking about. So Mansour Abbas, who is the most acquiescent or accommodationist of these three groupings today, identifies as part of the Islamic branch, southern Islamic branch of the Islamic movement, and is aligning himself with both the right in Israel, the political right in Israel, in terms of quashing or minimizing the rights for Palestinian citizens of Israel, and is also aligning himself with the right in terms of other sort of social movements and social conflicts that are happening within the state, but is not questioning the colonial underpinnings of the Israeli state itself. In contrast, you have Ra'ad Salah, head of the northern branch of the Islamic movement, who is much more forthright in questioning and in challenging the colonial underpinnings of Israel, has been at the forefront too, and I think this is sometimes overlooked, has really been at the forefront of challenging extremist Jewish claims over Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Old City of Jerusalem. And this goes back to the 90s, convening conferences calling with the theme Al-Aqsa is in danger, for example. So much of what we're seeing in terms of extremist Israeli Jews seeking to impose full Jewish control over Jerusalem, that's being pushed back against by members of the Northern Islamic branch precisely because they have greater access to Jerusalem than Palestinians under occupation. And so it's not about religious versus secular, but about how those religious movements align themselves with other political formations, and it can go in either way. So I don't see religion as inherently a friction or obstacle to political resolution. In fact, and I'm going to now jump here as the historian on the panel, I'm going to take us a little bit, very briefly, on a brief detour even further back into history. In my current book project, I'm tracing how Muslims, Christians, and Jews live together in Palestine from the Roman times to the present. And what's been striking to me is how, particularly under Muslim rule, we see people with very strongly held religious convictions nonetheless living together and recognizing one another's religious attachments, particularly in Jerusalem. And so shortly after Muslims conquered Jerusalem from the Byzantine army in the 7th century, the caliph at the time, Umar ibn al-Khattab, invited 70 Jewish families to settle in Jerusalem, marking the first time Jews lived in Jerusalem for 500 years following their exile in the Roman period. In the 16th century, the Ottoman ruler Suleiman issued an edict permitting Jews to have a place of prayer at the Western Wall in Jerusalem. Before that, they had prayed on the Mount of Olives. And, you know, many, many other examples in which, again, very strongly held religious conviction of multiple groups, nonetheless living together, particularly in Jerusalem, but throughout Palestine. And so what changed? And what changed, frankly, was Zionism, or to be more precise, a specific manifestation of political Zionism that envisioned Palestine, and particularly Jerusalem, as quote-unquote belonging to Jews. And it's this fusing of religion with exclusionary ethno-national claims that's so problematic, and not religious identity in and of itself. So that's what I think is really at the heart of all of this. Again, it's not religion in and of itself. It's the fusing of religion with exclusionary ethno-national claims, and what we need to do to move forward then is to disaggregate them once again. And the specific ways in which we'll do that, I think there's some really promising ideas laid out in this book that Leila has edited, in Rethinking Statehood in Palestine, and then there are also things that we can talk about further on.
You have been listening to a Harvard Divinity School Forum discussing Leila Farsak's new book, Rethinking Statehood in Palestine. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at WZBC 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. Eastern Time, and on kkrn.org, where you can stream us live every Friday morning at 8:30 a.m. Eastern Time. We thank you for joining us, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.